Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Welcome to another week. Richard Martin with Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, coming to you from Miami. Really grim day it is too. Black clouds, rain, wind. Not exactly what people sign up for when they come down here, but we all know that by tomorrow everything will be fine again. Such cannot, of course, be said about the economy, which I am afraid is looking worse and worse. It's in a situation, frankly, which is more than desperate. We are looking clearly at a government, a financial services network, which is absolutely out of control, unable to come even close to masterminding the problems that we have today. All this is, of course, orders of magnitude worse than it ever was during the Depression, and it's very, very worrying indeed. Ben Bernanke, for example, the chairman of the Fed, has repeatedly promised to use what he calls all of the powers at our disposal to get credit flowing again. And last week's initiatives are just another demonstration of what he means. The Fed and the Treasury agreed to guarantee $306 billion worth of assets belonging to Citigroup. They then created a $200 billion facility to purchase asset-backed securities. And, of course, most radically, the Fed promised to buy up to $500 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities guaranteed by government-sponsored enterprises, including the now nationalized mortgage agencies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and up to $100 billion worth of their direct debt. The effect is immediate. The yields on the securities plunged by 40 basis points, and the 30-year mortgage rate fell from a shade over 6% to 5.8%. Now, I wanted to look into Ben Bernanke. It's time we gave him a little bit of heat here, because this is a man who was selected by George Bush, not exactly known for his prescience in selecting anybody for any position of power anywhere. But he chose Ben Bernanke because probably Alan Greenspan proposed him, and so, of course, we're dealing with another Alan Greenspan residue. Ben Bernanke taught economics for many years at Princeton University, where he was known for his retiring manner and his statistics-laden research on the Great Depression. I thought it would have been him. Like Greenspan, he slashed interest rates, he established new lending programs, he extended hundreds of billions of dollars to troubled financial firms. He bought debt issued by industrial corporations such as General Electric, and even taken distressed mortgage assets onto the Fed's book, entirely in contravention of the aegis of the Fed, which requires only the highest quality AAA assets to be pledged in exchange for loans. He has caused much frustration, not least of all with Dean Baker, the co-director for the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which is a liberal think tank in Washington, who said, and I quote, "He was behind the curve at every stage of the story. He didn't see the housing bubble until after it burst. Until as late as this summer, he downplayed all the risks involved. In terms of policy, he has not presented a clear view. On a number of occasions, he has pointed in one direction and then turned around and acted differently. I would be surprised if Obama wanted to reappoint him when his term ends in January 2010. Well, 6.5 years ago, Bernanke was a little-known professor living in Montgomery Township, a hamlet near Princeton. Long hours, enormous stress, and constant criticism have left him looking pale and drawn, quoting Richard Fisher, the president of the Dallas Fed. Ben is a very decent and sincere person. And the question is that an asset or a liability on his job? Well, the only precursor for the current financial crisis is the Great Depression, but even that isn't a very good comparison. As I was saying earlier on Gary's show, in the 1930s, the financial system was much less sophisticated and interconnected. In dealing with the problems affecting arcane new financial products, including collateralized debt obligations, credit default swaps, and tri-party repos, Bernanke and his colleagues have had to become expert in market transactions of baffling intricacy. Well, during his junior year, he scored 1,590 out of 1,600 on his SAT, the highest score in South Carolina that year, and the state awarded him a trip to Europe. In the fall of 1971, he entered Harvard, where he wrote a prize-winning senior thesis on the economic effects of U.S. energy policy. After graduating, he enrolled at MIT, whose PhD program in economics was rated the best in the country. His doctoral thesis was a dense mathematical treatise on the causes of economic fluctuation. Well, in March 2005, Bernanke argued that the main source of imbalance in the global economy was not excess spending at home, but rather excess saving in China and other developing countries where consumption was artificially low. Laxed American policy was helping to mop up a global savings glut. Well, there, ladies and gentlemen, you have the first fatal error. There is no such thing as a savings glut. You are entitled to save as much money as you wish. The more money you save on a personal basis, the better you may think that you will live in retirement, all things being equal. Therefore, there are people who save and save and save, and they're called Japanese. Americans are called people who spend and spend and spend. And Bernanke has the audacity to blame China for saving money, you know, and to deny that excess spending was taking place. How could he do that? Looking around and seeing how people were buying houses they couldn't afford, how people were buying cars at 0%, and people were being thrown money from all directions, and he's saying that Americans were not spending in an excessive way. You know, we didn't have a global savings glut. We had an American consumption glut. And in both of those cases, Bernanke was complicit in massive policy blunders on the part of the Fed, long before the crisis ever hit. But of course, during that time, I was able to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that that was exactly what we had to expect. And again, I'm neither a genius nor a soothsayer nor a prophet. I'm simply a person who looks down the tunnel and sees the logic of the situation and brings it to your attention. You know, in August 2005, Bernanke said, and I quote, "I think it is important to point out that house prices are being supported in very large part by very strong fundamentals. We have lots of jobs, employment, high incomes, very low mortgage rates, growing population, and shortages of land and housing in many areas. And those supply and demand factors are a big reason why house prices have risen as much as they have." You know, I remind you, ladies and gentlemen, this is a man who specialized in the Great Depression. This means he saw and he studied the real estate boom in Florida very closely, being as it was a prime motivator in the meltdown which then caused the Great Depression. And he is saying that there's anything different in what happened then from now. I mean, what happens when you talk to people like this? What happens when you sit down at a table with someone like Ben Bernanke and you have a little chat? Who gets up and walks away first is the only question on my mind. Poor fool. Here's another, you know, golden comment out of history. Ben Bernanke, in 2005, again. Where once more marginal applicants would simply have been denied credit, lenders are now able to quite efficiently judge the risks posed by individual applicants and to price that risk appropriately. In May 2006, he rejected calls for direct regulation of hedge funds, saying that such a move would, quote, stifle innovation. The following month, in a speech on bank supervision, he expressed support for allowing banks rather than government officials to determine how much risk they could take on using complicated mathematical models of their own devising, a policy that had been in place for a number of years. And I quote, "The ongoing work on this framework has already led large, complex banking organizations to improve their systems for identifying, measuring, and managing their risks." Here's the man who is now entrusted with dealing with the problems that he encouraged back in 2005. How crazy is that? How likely is it that he can possibly come up with the solutions to the problems that he himself encouraged not 3 years ago, ladies and gentlemen? How about this? Quote, "The U.S. economy appears to be making a transition from the rapid rate of expansion experienced over the preceding years to a more sustainable average pace of growth," he told the Senate Banking Committee in February 2007. By then, of course, home prices in many parts of the country had begun to drop. Even as late as February, the end of February, February 28, 2007, Bernanke told the House Budget Committee that he didn't consider the housing downturn, quote, "as being a broad financial concern or a major factor in assessing the state of the economy." He maintained an upbeat tone over the next several months, during which two large subprime lenders, New Century Financial Corp and American Home Mortgage, filed for bankruptcy, and the damage spread to Wall Street firms that had invested in subprime securities. You know, even Jim Cramer, you know, the shill for Wall Street, the Pollyanna par extraordinaire, yelled, and I remember this was a famous speech where Cramer lost it, and he said, "Bernanke is being an academic. He has no idea how bad it is out there. My people have been in this game for 25 years, and they are losing their jobs, and these firms are going to go out of business, and he's nuts. They're nuts. They know nothing." Does anybody remember that speech? It was on the nightly news because the guy just lost. He started throwing things and banging the desk and everything. I mean, the guy, that was the apotheosis of Jim Cramer's, you know, crazed antics on his nightly show on CNBC. You know, what is encompassed only the second part of the Bernanke doctrine, its most radical component. Over 15 months, beginning in August 2007, the Fed, through various novel programs known by their initials, such as TAF, TSLF, PDCF, lent more than $1 trillion to dozens of institutions. Well, Richard Fisher, the head of the Dallas Fed, said that the lending programs would be Bernanke's main legacy. Despite the rate cuts, the lending programs, months passed without discernible improvements in the credit markets. During the summer and fall of 2007, the drop in house prices accelerated and the number of subprime delinquencies increased. In October, at a meeting in Washington, central bankers, executives, and economists, Alan Sinai, the chief economist of Decision Economics, Inc., asked Bernanke how he thought a central bank should manage the economic risks posed by a housing bubble. According to Sinai, Now wait for this, ladies and gentlemen. Sit down for this. Bernanke said he had no way of knowing if there had been a housing bubble. I remind you, we're talking about the fall of 2007, just over 1 year ago. Well, said Sinai, I realized then that he just didn't realize the scale of the problem. All right. It's my job. Richard Martin's wake-up call. That is as it is. I try to bring it to you in as restrained a fashion as possible, but it isn't always possible, ladies and gentlemen. Let me give you, please, my information. I am Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's wake-up call, and you are encouraged to call in and air your grievances, your pet rants, ask your questions, discuss whatever needs to be discussed, and the number to call is a toll-free one at 888-873-4643. Once more, please call in. The engineer will be waiting for your call, and he will hold it and then pass it on to me as soon as we have an appropriate break in the proceedings. Once more, the phone number to call, please, ladies and gentlemen, 888-873-4643. If you would like to write in your questions by means of an email, you are more than welcome to do that too. If you do so, please write to the following email address. rmartin@gscorporation.com. Once more. And by the way, the GS stands for Global Strategic. The word corporation needs to be written out in full. Once again, please, the email, please note, rmartin@gscorporation.com. Okay? Now, if you do want to call me with your personal questions, your concerns, you may do that, and I would welcome it. And please, if you wish to do so, call me privately at any time on the following number, my direct line, which is 305-357-5575. Once more, let me give you my direct line. It is 305-357-5575. That's for you to call if you'd like to speak to me personally. Don't worry about calling me any time. If I'm busy, I will take your number and call you back. But one way or another, we'll deal with your issue. Okay. Well, just expanding a little bit more, you know, on not Bernanke so much, but the general economic school of thought, I cannot emphasize enough how important it is to understand that economists are relying on hugely flawed theories and models when looking at the economy. You know, the economic policy is being made of the neoclassical theory of economics, which is just a fancy way of describing current mainstream economic theory. This neoclassical theory of economics forms the basis for all the nonsense your politicians and their advisors keep trying. The greatest failed experiment of this theory is the practical implementation of Keynesian and neo-Keynesian economic policy. Today, right now, you are witnessing the implementation of this Keynesian theory to its absolute maximum limits with a policy of what they call ZERP, which is zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing. Now, I'm going to explain all this too, so don't panic, ladies and gentlemen. But before we do that, let's take three calls. The first comes from Russell in Virginia. Hi, Russell.
Hello, Richard.
I have a question
about, this is my circumstance. I moved to Virginia 4 years ago because I knew of, or I had a good feeling of this financial situation happening then. And I sold everything, took my family, and moved to Virginia. And I'm in a really rural area, small town of 50,000 people. Now, my question is that during this thing that, you know, with the depression that's going to happen, is my best location here or back in New York where I moved away from? Because I was afraid to stay in New York thinking that when this all happens, I didn't want to be a part of 17 million people searching for work and food. But now I don't feel as secure in this area because I really don't know that many people, and I always had work in New York.
What kind of work did you have in New York?
I do home improvements or, you know, general repairs and, you know, handyman stuff like that.
Well, I mean, I don't know what's important to you in life. I mean, I don't know why you chose Virginia in particular, but you do probably want to choose a fairly affluent built-up area for your work to ensure yourself with the maximum chance of getting work. I don't know whereabouts you are in Virginia, but I suspect that you try to kind of opt out, and basically what you've done has been very intelligent, I think, by selling everything out. But I think you might look for an area, you know, which is more heavily built up, that can use your expertise and your skills. And of course, they will be in demand, and people still have, you know, things that have to be done to their homes. There may be less of them, but you need to be positioned in a place where you feel that you can have the maximum impact in terms of your skills. And if you feel that Virginia is that, then stay there. But that's really what you should be looking at. I mean, is that, I was going to say that obvious, but is it something that you don't agree with? Is what I say?
Yeah, well, my fear was that it's really cheap for me to live here. You know, my rent is only $300 a month, and, you know, I can make that, you know, sometimes easily to cover my rent with no problem. But in New York, you know, the rents are much higher. And, you know, it was really based on fear that I moved away from New York, although I know
no,
I feel
you made
so
a good
much
move. To move away from New York was obviously a good move. I mean, I don't think that's in question. The question is whether you should be somewhere where your skills are more in demand. I mean, are you aware of just how grim the situation is going to be? You know, we're not just talking about a run-of-the-mill garden variety recession here. We're talking about a rip-roaring depression such as the world has never witnessed in its history. That's the kind of focus that you should be having. And in that respect, you do need to be, you know, positioned for a lot of work. And you know, if you can, you know, make a trade-off between cheap rent and, you know, an adequate work environment, and Virginia is it, then stay there. If it isn't, then my message to you is to look for somewhere where there is definitely more work along the lines that you feel comfortable with. That's what I would say to you. That's about it.
Yeah, because my position here... Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Russell. Appreciate it. Paul from New Jersey, we have you on the line. Hi.
Hello. Hi, Richard. I want to ask you If I have money like in a save hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah, it's a little hard to hear. It's a little hard to hear you. Can you either speak closer to the telephone or you know, I don't know what else you can do, but go ahead.
I have savings and loan. It's like a money market, not in a stock market. Is that safe?
Savings and loan, no, that's not safe at all. I'm not quite sure what kind of a money market you may have. It's the investments of the money market itself that are in question. You need to be in a Treasury bill money market fund. And you need to make that change, you know, presto, because things are not looking good and you could be in trouble. They say that the money market funds are insured. With the amount of money there inside, I have my grave doubts as to how much they can actually insure, and more importantly, how long it might take to get you paid back. So you do need to be in government money market funds, which are senior in line of repayment from the federal government in terms of their treasury bills. So remember, it must say treasury bill, and it must contain treasury bills. Amazingly enough, a lot of these treasury bill money market funds say they're labeled treasury bills, you know, like these products which are called without sugar, and you look at the ingredients, and it's high, you know, grade Thirds, something like that. You just need to be careful to look inside and see what's inside those funds. But that's where you need to be, Paul. Okay?
Yeah, one more thing, please. And what about the money in, like, an online trading firm, brokerage firm?
Well, you should be okay. And I've always said, you know, that actually, paradoxically, money with a broker is probably safer than money with a bank, because money with a bank simply gets spent by the bank. Money with a broker is segregated for your use as and when you wish to invest it. So provided it's less than $500,000, of which $100,000 would be in cash, you should be fine. I wouldn't worry about it. But at the same time, be cautious as to what you're invested in, because your money is only secure as long as the investments are themselves secure. If you are invested in stocks or risky bonds or anything which isn't pretty much the purview of the federal government, then you could be in trouble. So make sure that you keep responsible investments in those accounts as well, okay?
Right. And which banks are safe?
I'm sorry, which what?
Which banks are safe?
Well, for that you need to go to thestreet.com, okay? Write that down, thestreet.com. And you navigate through to find out the list of banks. There is a listing of all the banks in thestreet.com, and they've got ratings. And you can find, you know, a bank which is near you, which is highly rated, which means that it has an adequate asset base to cover its liabilities. The best, of course, is one-to-one, and there are some that are out there which are very conservative. But in my opinion, if you go to thestreet.com, we'll come up with some interesting ideas. So I suggest that you do that, and let me know if you have a problem with that. Okay? Anyway, let me just go on talking a little bit more about what I was discussing. In other words, the policy which comes out of the minds of these economists and how it sort of comes to be. You know, as I said, they are using what they call the neoclassical economic theory, but that is fatally flawed, even from its very first basic premises, which are, there are really three tenets here. Firstly, people are said to have rational preferences among outcomes that can be identified and associated with a value. Secondly, individuals are said to maximize utility, and firms are said to maximize profits. And thirdly, it is supposed that people act independently on the basis of full and relevant information. I'm going to talk a little bit about those three things right now. But this entire theory and all the economic policy that is born of it hinges on these three basic premises. The first one, i.e. the one about people having rational preferences among outcomes, it is completely ridiculous and obvious to anybody that isn't a socially inept, ivory tower, academic, economic nerd. These people have obviously never interacted with the general public, with basic psychology. You know, the assumption is that these individuals choose the best action according to stable preference functions and constraints facing them. And put, you know, simply in an interesting analogy, if you prefer beer over liquor, you'll consistently drink beer at parties. No flip-flopping is allowed. No randomization is allowed. No living in the moment is allowed. And this brings me to the second premise about individuals maximizing utility and firms maximizing profits. Again, using the beer analogy, basically, the idea is that you drink your beer to the point of being pleasantly buzzed and then you stop. You never get smashed because a massive hangover clearly doesn't maximize utility. And the third premise, the one about people acting independently on the basis of full and relevant information, this means that you happily drink your beer and won't get persuaded to do a round of shots with your friends. You clearly know that one round leads to two, and you got to work tomorrow. When your drunken friend gives you a stock tip, you act independently and only after you've figured out everything humanly possible about the company and the industry. You aren't at all persuaded by the fact that all your friends jumped on the stock and are making a killing. You stay completely level-headed all the time. You see, the problem with economists is that they cannot cope with the unexpected. If economists were to be confronted with the reality of life, excuse me, both social and economic, they would be discredited immediately because there would be no way for them to ever make predictions about the future. And that's exactly why we find ourselves in this condition. That's exactly why people like Ben Bernanke, who are clearly very intelligent beings, are completely blind to see that their policies have no reliability whatsoever. You know, this is not the same thing as taking a car out for a spin and knowing that you're going to get back in one piece. If it was as hard to drive a car as it is to drive an economy, the roads, ladies and gentlemen, would be empty, because nobody could possibly ever assume that they would arrive in one piece. And that's how it is in economics. And that's how it is that people got blindsided by the collapse of the economy earlier this year. Now, it isn't as though we don't have examples of this in history. You know, the tulip mania, the South Sea bubble, the dot-com bubble, and even the current real estate bubble ought to be more than enough evidence to absolutely destroy all three of those premises that I just mentioned. Now, the truly successful traders and investors, of course, know all this already. They thrive in a chaotic, irrational, and uncertain environment. And that's exactly what we need to conjure up among, you know, the people who listen to the show, the people who invest. They have to understand that, as I said before, stability implies inexorably instability. Because the more stable and the longer that an economy is stable, the more people will take risks, thereby creating instability. Because they will consider that the risks they are taking are bound and grounded by the stability of the system in which they're taking the risks. Little realizing, of course, that they're creating instability by so doing. You know? But I don't know why it has to be me that brings your attention to this. Or that has to draw attention to this when people like Bernanke should have enough intelligence to know that this will happen. In the end, I think it's hubris. I think it's just egoism. These people think they own the world. They think that they run the system. Somebody who says to you that China is to blame because there is a savings glut in China and that there isn't excessive spending in America clearly is not looking at the road ahead. These are people who are infused with a sense of the ultimate righteousness of America and the American economy. You know, it really doesn't make any sense to believe in people who talk like that. I mean, you can get annoyed, you can get upset, but in the end, you need to shake your head and just ignore what they say and what they do. And that's why I'm here to tell you today that everything that these people are doing to try to save the system is doing nothing but ruin it. And the more they try, the longer it will take and the worse it will be. I'm sorry, but that's the reality that we have to live with. All right. Again, my phone-in number is 888-873-4643. Once again, 888-873-4643. All right, just want to say a quick word, you know, about the Barack Obama administration. This has nothing to do with politics, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not getting into politics here. I'm merely commenting on the coming set of morons that are about to, you know, unleash their wretched wit on the economy and other parts of our society. All of which to tell you that despite whatever Barack Obama might have said about change, no change is to be expected. And Ralph Nader predicted this, and he couldn't have been righter. I mean, basically, you've got the Clinton clan back in action. Barack Obama picking, again, the very people who helped get us into this financial mess to lead us out of it. I mean, you know, watching the president-elect's Monday introduction of his economic team, somebody said, you can see the feathers coming out of their mouths as the foxes were once again put in charge of the hen house. You know, but, you know, Obama putting his seal of approval on the Citigroup bailout, endorsed by the proteges of Citigroup Executive Committee Chairman Robert Rubin, a bailout bringing $245 billion of taxpayer money thrown at Citigroup, and a guarantee of $306 billion for the bank's toxic securities, that, which, by the way, would have been illegal if there hadn't been changes in law that Citigroup secured, with the decisive help of Rubin and Lawrence Summers, the man who replaced him as Secretary of Treasury in the Clinton administration. Rubin was awarded with $15 million a year executive position at Citigroup. I mean, it's so frustrating, it's hard for me to even bring this to you, you know. Paulson indicated last week that no further bailouts were planned before the new administration took office. You know, until Rubin, by the way, an old colleague himself from Goldman Sachs, he told Paulson in phone calls that the government had to act. You know, this outrageous conflict of interest in which Rubin gets to exploit his ties to both the outgoing and incoming administrations was best described by the Washington Post as, quote, the ultimate irony, of course, is that just as Rubin and co at Citi were being bailed out by the Bush administration, President-elect Barack Obama was getting set to announce a new economic team drawn almost entirely from Rubin acolytes. You know? Why has he appointed the very people responsible for this disaster to now make it all better? You know, ask him. It's time for many people who responded to his emails during the campaign to now challenge the email buddy as to why he suddenly acts as if the interests of Wall Street and Main Street are one and the same. Well, well, well. Let's take a few more emails. I've gone and lost them all. I have them here somewhere, but we'll find them before the day is out. Okay, let's take one that came up from Anthony Johnson. Richard. Well, according to CNN, it's official. The U.S. is in a recession. How long do you think this will last? Do you have any suggestions for places to live? Which jobs do you see not disappearing? What type of jobs will be created? Anthony. Well, Anthony, we have gone over this quite considerably in the past, so I'm going to deal with it really quickly. I think this will last at least 4 or 5 years. But remember, what I'm talking about is going down the slippery slope. 4 or 5 years basically is the time it'll take to reach rock bottom, but we'll be bouncing along rock bottom for a lot longer than that. So I would say don't look for any increase in the foreseeable future. Places to live, I would say anywhere which allows you to live as cheaply as possible, and to pursue your chosen line of professional endeavor. Obviously, from my perspective, it will be a warm place. Some people don't mind that. If you are of a mind to live abroad, Costa Rica and Panama come quickly to mind. They're close. You speak Spanish, perhaps. If not, you can learn. There are lots of Americans there. Which jobs do you see not disappearing? I think those connected with the immediate medical services, such as nurses, which I've been talking about at great length in the past. There is an acute shortage of nurses right now. I think that obvious federal jobs will be in demand, you know, mail deliverers, although the mail service is apparently cutting down. Food distribution, that's also, obviously an important issue. the type of jobs that will be created. I don't know that there'll be any real creation of new lines of work, but you probably wouldn't want to look at those anyway. You want to look at the tried and trusted lines of work which thrive in a recession, such as the ones I've mentioned. Jonathan Spokley comes in with an email called Deflation. He says, hi, Steve. Oh, I wonder who Steve might be. Well, never mind, let's continue. Even though the country is in a deflationary period, I don't see one of the most important substances people need to live deflating, and that is food. Grocery prices ran up when oil prices were skyrocketing last summer, but now that oil prices have come back down, grocery store prices seem to be still going up. How do you explain this? Should we expect food prices to continue to rise? The answer is probably not, actually. Jonathan, I think that food prices will come down along with everything else. People are definitely going to eat less. They're going to eat more staple foods, I think, rather than the kind of processed food that we've come to know. The cost of distributing food has come down quite significantly with the drop in the price of oil. So I would look for food prices to be a lagging indicator of the depths of the downturn. That they will turn down, I think, in the foreseeable future. We have Jack calling from Manhattan. Good afternoon, Jack. How can we help you?
I would like to first congratulate you. I am 73 years old, and I listen to many radios. Programs and read many articles, and I haven't found anybody who came out as direct as you did with some logic and real down-to-earth advice. So this is, I believe in complimenting, even though I don't have the accolades, you know, the professional PhDs, but just from living life. I thought about this problem, but not as deep as you did develop it. So for the last 4 years, I took, I would say, a good part of my liquid cash, and I gave it to, I said I'm going to give it to the biggest crook, which will be the U.S. government, and I opened up an account with the Treasury, and that's where I have most of my liquid cash. I live in Manhattan. And I certainly could have sold my apartment earlier, before, but I have to live someplace. So I like a city environment, so I figured I'll stay because my way of looking at it, this will take probably another 4 years to work itself through. And what I did do is I have enough liquid cash that I can survive the next 4 or 5 years, up to 10 years, without any other income coming in. So I think I did what you said to do. My reason of calling you is that I am a Holocaust survivor. I came to the United States when I was 13, almost 13, never went to school, and did very well. Educated my kids, no debt. What I'd like to leave the public who's listening to is that there is no perfect solution in my mind or safety in any mind. We just have to be reasonable, believe that there's a tomorrow, get up and do your work. And I hope and I believe that in the next 4 or 5 years, if we get a proper leadership, but it has to come from the depth of a depression, we can solve all the, the energy needs that we have. We have nanotechnology. We have enough technology come in the pipeline, I believe, from what I read, that will give us a very promising future. But I have to commend you on your information. And I hope that in the very near future, I will call you and set up my thoughts. Because, you see, I do believe if I survive for the next 10 years, and probably I have a good chance, I'm only 73, there will be enough technology to take me out another 10 years. So I go in a 10-year cycle, basically. But I would like to thank you for your information and your honesty and your, as you say, in your saying Yiddish, the chutzpah to tell the truth. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jack. I appreciate the accolades, and I do my best. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to be right. I always point this out to people because I've been exceptionally right so far, but I'm going to make mistakes, and when I do, it will come as a shock and surprise to people because they won't be expecting it. But I am not infallible, and so take everything I say in perspective. You know, go out there, check my words against what other people say. I've given people, especially in the emails that I send out, a lot of information about other people who think like I do. And basically, I formulate my own thoughts on other people's thoughts. And I don't really have my own particular brand of original thinking. I tend to read a lot and to develop my thoughts basis what other people have come up with. So, you know, just by dint of taking a group of people who I respect immensely and trying to take the consensus of those people, because sometimes they go dangerously off course. For example, I'll give you an example. Peter Schiff, who has been one of the prime thinkers in terms of the downturn and very accurate in his assessment of the problem, has been horrendously wrong in terms of the solution that he has offered. And so, you know, one doesn't necessarily have to connect up the diagnosis, as it were, with the cure. So, you know, I am human, Jack, and do remember that I should, my own opinion should be taken in the context of a lot of other people's opinion, and then I think you're very likely to get a good grasp of what's happening over the longer term. Right. Well, thank you very much for that. I'd like to just give you a few figures here about what's been happening. You know, given the speed at which the federal government is throwing money at the financial crisis, the average taxpayer might not be faulted for losing track. CNBC has actually been paying very close attention and keeping a running tally of actual spending as well as the commitments involved. And the total would appear to come out to $4.28 trillion. And I mentioned this before. This is more than what was spent on World War II, which was the second largest initial outlay of money. And, of course, that's adjusted for inflation. You know, it is obviously not only an astronomical amount of money, but it's a complicated cocktail of budgeted dollars, actual spending guarantees, loan swaps, and other market mechanisms by the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and other offices of government. Taken over roughly the last year, some 68% of the sum falls under the Federal Reserve's umbrella. Another 16% is under the Troubled Asset Relief Program, commonly known as TARP, as defined under the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, signed into law in early October. Just so you know, those are the figures, and those are what we have to deal with in the future. You know, and you know, obviously, again, you know, Paulson and Bernanke between them are without doubt causing lasting damage. You know, before the barrage of information about Japan even comes across, you know, it is very obvious that there is a big difference between the U.S. and Japan, who underwent a form of depression in the 90s. You know, and obviously the key point, and I'm always asked about this, is that Japan headed into its own deflation with net savings, while the U.S., you know, is entering deflation deep in debt, and that's what makes the situation in the United States all the more dire. You know, and again, I'm afraid to tell you that all these attempts to prop up the stock market and housing prices, they're all doomed to fail. You know, the pool of real savings is depleted, and you know, you can't get something for nothing. And it was Greenspan and Bernanke, both of them, who lorded over Japan on how the Japanese banks needed to write off bad debts before Japan could have a sustainable recovery. You know? And that's quite ironic when you look at and to see what they're doing with the banks today in this country, throwing money at them. You know, and what is really alarming is that this flawed economic thinking that I mentioned earlier on is actually gaining ground when it should be losing it. Economics is like physics. Austrian economics embraces sound principles where the pool of real savings created from production and income dictates the price of lending. The Keynesian economics, the economics of throwing money at the problem, is like alchemy, you know, trying to change the real into something else. It's based on short-term manipulations affecting the price of lending. These manipulations create imbalances that must be corrected. But you see, unfortunately, the government policy tries harder and harder to keep the alchemy going. You know, the greatest socialist institution ever created was a central bank given the authority to create money. And as I said before, last week, instead of the price of lending being dependent on production and income, you remember the example I gave of the bread maker and the shoemaker, the price of lending is determined by bureaucrats incentivized to make that price as cheap as possible at all times. This does not create wealth. It just creates imbalances. Real wealth is created only by production, and production is a function of the real market seeking profit. So in the end, you come up with Keynesian economic theory, which is what all this nonsense is based on. The same failed something-for-nothing theory of perpetual notion. Attempts to get something for nothing. A complete waste of time and resources. And as I say, it can only make things worse. Very grim, very sad, ladies and gentlemen, but I've got much, much more to talk to you about, and hopefully it's giving you an insight into all this, you know. Well, we're out of time, as always, so I'm going to have to bid you farewell until Thursday. This is Richard Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Bye-bye for now.